This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, this is The Money. I'm Richard Aidy. Think of the country most important to Australia, and it could well be China. It's the biggest exporter and trading nation in the world, and our largest trading partner. So today, what that means, how it happened, and the economic statecraft that China practices. Let's begin with some numbers. Economist Jane Golley is acting director of the ANU's China in the World Centre.
It's currently the second biggest in the world. It's a $12 trillion economy in 2017, and that's measured in current prices. If you measure it in purchasing power parity terms, it becomes the biggest economy in the world, basically because the buying power of renminbi within China is strong. But anyway, it ranks in nominal terms as the second largest economy in the world.
By 2030, China is expected to be much bigger, perhaps twice the size of the US economy. But how valuable is it to Australia now? James Lawrenson's in the Australia-China Relations Institute at the University of Technology in Sydney.
We ship and sell services worth $116 billion to China. That's about 6.6% of Australia's GDP, the size of Australia's economy. It's been an interesting shift over the last 5 years as well. It's not just the importance of the dollar value, the $116 billion, it's also what we're selling to China. 10 years ago, it really was iron ore, coal. Now we ship $10 billion worth of agricultural goods to China. We sell them more than $15 billion worth of services. By that, I'm talking about education and tourism mainly. So we're shipping a more diverse basket of goods and services, as well as more of them.
Increasingly, China's a market for high-value goods and services, and you can see that in our tourism stats.
Now there are around 1.4 million Chinese tourists visiting Australia every year. That's the most from any country. But each of them spend around $8,500 per trip. Now, the average American spends less than half that. The average New Zealander spends about a quarter of that. So that's your point. Not only are there more of them, they also spend a lot more while they're here. Very good news story for the Australian tourism sector.
And although what China wants from us is changing, what they have at home is changing faster. Like the gigantic e-commerce company Alibaba, founded by Jack Ma.
Alibaba, I think, is one of the biggest companies in the world. I mean, they produce just about everything. Jack Ma ranks, I think, in the top five, might be the fifth wealthiest person in the world. You can't not know about Alibaba if you're in China, but I think more and more here, you know, you travel across Asia, a lot of countries you're paying using forms of, you know, credit card systems are sort of no longer in use, and Alibaba's really led the way in e-commerce, in, you know, online purchasing in so many different areas. They are a massive force to be reckoned with.
And there's apparently a ride-hailing app, Didi, which is bigger than Uber.
That's now the biggest ride-hailing app in the world. So both of those companies are good examples of just how far China's come. I mean, I really feel quite provincial and hick when I'm in Beijing because I can't do everything on my phone. I don't have the WePay set up, and I don't know how to book a restaurant by going onto whatever systems that they use. We just don't have the same technology here. There, nowadays, people travel across the country and even abroad without taking any cash because they assume that everywhere else would, of course, also be a cashless economy. Only in China, you feel like you say that a lot when you watch that country change.
The novelist William Gibson famously said, "The future's already here. It's just unevenly distributed."
You know, I'd recommend anyone to go and see Beijing and Shanghai to start with. And then if you want to talk about unevenness, make sure you get out and see the rest of the country as well so that you get a good sense of the inequalities within China. They now have 660-odd billionaires, the largest number of billionaires in the world. Most of them live in the big metropolises like Shanghai and Beijing. And again, I feel like a hick coming out of the country who can't afford to look in the shop windows, let alone step inside them. They've transformed into metropolises, and again, just standing on anywhere on the streets in either of those cities, you really get a sense that the world centre of gravity, in economic terms at least, has changed, and there's no turning back. So yeah, the future's arrived, and I still say it's in China.
On On the Money today, we are all about China. Economically, it's been an astonishing success story. But 40 years ago, it was not.
It's kind of a luxurious. If you have some kind of meat on the table.
This is Lee Gongsong. These days, he's Professor of Economics at the Australian National University.
I remember when we were little, we all very look forward to the China's Spring Festival. And that's a Chinese New Year. During the celebration, you know, we can have some kind of new clothes and new shoes, new socks. But importantly, because of the supply will be more over that festivities, so therefore the children can enjoy the meat and the candies.
Back then, basic foodstuffs were in short supply.
Rationing was there, and the household, through their registration system, they are being allocated through that system, you know, as a member of the family and accounted as a number. And the coupons will be issued in purchasing the grains and clothing, edible oil, perhaps sugar and others. So every month, you know, people are queuing there to get a coupon. And using that coupon, you can guarantee to buy those goods. So the living standards are low, but at the same time, for those people who are living in city, like we are living in Beijing, so you don't feel, you know, hunger or something.
But in the countryside, there was hunger. And in 1979, that's where Deng Xiaoping began to change the economy.
One of the first reforms was to de-collectivise the agricultural communes and basically say to the rural people, produce what you like, or at least some of what you could produce you can sell in private, newly emerging markets, and, you know, give a human being an incentive to make a bit of money when they've, some of them, spent several years under extreme hunger, and they'll get out there and find ways to make it. And I think no more so than the Chinese rural community.
It didn't stop with the countryside. Deng instituted a series of reforms.
Number one is the marketization. And under the central planning, there is no what we understood as a proper market. So therefore, moving from a centrally planned economy to a market system. So the number one issue, the priority, is to liberalize the price. So that's exactly what China did. And when the market prices are being liberalized, you can see the resource allocation, sending the signals.
That was critical. And so was decentralization.
Used to be under the central planning, that everything is controlled, very highly controlled or centralized in Beijing. The system are running inefficiently just because the information problem and the incentive problem. When the power being decentralized, so local government has a tremendous incentive and through those, the autonomy to develop their economy. So they are the drivers for growth later on. The third big change is the ownership change. Used to be under central planning, you know, all the assets are being owned by the state. And since the beginning of reform, those start changing. So diversity of the ownership and through the privatization of SOE, through the development of spontaneously the indigenous private sector, but also very importantly, through the introduction of a foreign direct investment. So foreign capital also flowing in.
The Chinese government also carefully opened its borders to trade and foreign direct investment, which brought in technologies, know-how and ideas. And it allowed people to move.
Before reform started, the majority of the people are still living in the rural area, about 80% of them. Under central planning system, there is a household registration system in place. They have a very clear divide between urban and rural. Basically, people cannot move from rural to urban, despite the big income differences. So therefore, when the reform started, this kind of control being relaxed. So farmers are choosing to move to cities. So overall now, nearly 300 million workers are moving from rural to urban. And plus, you know, their family member and et cetera. In development literature, we call this a resource shift effect. That means that you don't increase the total number of workers, but moving resources from a low productivity area into the higher one. The economy has a net gains in terms of output and productivity.
It adds up to a transformation, but it wasn't a quick one. the Chinese went considerably slower than the Russians did at about the same time.
Very much slower. I mean, we talk about the Big Bang in Russia, 1989, and where markets are essentially introduced overnight. Of course, it takes a bit longer than that, but they free up the exchange rate, they reintroduce money into the system, they had quick and rapid privatization of the great big state-owned companies, and it all happened very, very quickly in China. And you used a good word, it's a transformation. It's been a reform of a process as opposed to a transition from one system of command planning to another, a textbook sort of market capitalist system. Instead, Deng famously said that he would grope at stones to cross the river by moving slowly and introducing reforms in one part of the country, seeing how they worked and then enabling them to spread elsewhere.
That deliberate approach has lifted hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. Li Gongsun.
At the beginning of reform, the per capita income is about less than $200. By last year, the 2017, the per capita income rises to $8,600. So you can see during the first 3 decades of reform and the development, China achieved a double-digit growth, nearly 10% per annum in real term, in terms of a per capita income growth. That's perhaps surpassed the Japan and Asianese in their high or peak period of growth. And of course, that economy now slowing down for China.
This is The Money on RN, the ABC Listen app, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Richard Aidy. Today, we're looking at China and the 40-year transformation of its economy. As you know, the country now has real economic heft. With heft comes clout. And China, like other countries with clout, is using it in the form of foreign aid and, more significantly, capital investment. But as James Riley, who is at the University of Sydney, explains, China does it differently.
It is different in certain important ways. And the most obvious and probably the most important one is the scale of the state sector in the economy. So the banking sector is entirely owned by the state. There are very large sovereign wealth funds, obviously controlled by state actors. And the largest companies in the country are overwhelmingly are state-owned enterprises, the SOEs. So that combination of sort of a government influence over the economy within China means that at least some sector of the government can at least try to use those economic resources for foreign policy goals as well as commercial ones abroad. That's pretty distinctive. The second really distinctive thing of China, I think, is the scale of the country. And that's true whenever you study or think about Chinese politics. In the case of the economic realm, the scale of the market in terms of the market power that China can bring to bear, as well as the number of people that are Chinese citizens or ethnic Chinese around the world. So in Southeast Asia, for example, the Chinese diaspora is a fantastic resource that Beijing is continually interested in trying to use for various purposes.
China has big carrots and big sticks, but also, apparently, big challenges.
One of the challenges that I think China has in implementing what I and a lot of people call economic statecraft is that there are multiple goals that any sort of major initiative seeks to achieve abroad. So if China, for example, is funding pipelines across Myanmar, oil and gas pipelines that have recently, a couple of years ago, come online, those are there for multiple purposes. Certainly, there's a strategic benefit to being able to have oil and gas go directly into southwestern China, going around the Malacca Straits. But there are also commercial benefits as well to this, and there should certainly be a return on the investment. There are many actors involved in this, all of which have different interests. So Yunnan province, where the pipelines end up, has a major interest in this project going forward. And of course, the state-owned enterprises are involved in this with many long-term commercial objectives. So there's sort of multiple strategic, commercial, regional, as well as foreign policy or political goals that go into any major such initiative. Pulling those threads apart and trying to figure out which one of them is sort of driven by Xi Jinping and some strategic or foreign policy goal is very hard to do.
And there can be pushback against this economic statecraft, like recently in Malaysia.
I think the instance in Malaysia is very interesting and in some ways very typical of the challenges China faces in trying to use economic resources abroad for strategic benefit. And that is that politics can change. So when you get a change in the leadership of any given country, it's very likely that the new president or prime minister may come into power promising to bring about changes. And certainly in the foreign relations, one of the major relationships they might look to change is China. So China's involvement in a lot of countries has been very controversial. And when there's a political turnover, oftentimes Chinese companies find themselves the target of political criticism. This has happened in Myanmar. This has happened in Africa, in Southern Africa, Zimbabwe, for example. And certainly in Malaysia, that's what we've seen most recently, where a change in the leadership, a return, a Mahathir to the prime ministership means that China has become sort of the target for a lot of this criticism.
But it can go the other way too. 10 years ago, then French President Sarkozy met the Dalai Lama.
Well, certainly one of the ways that China uses its economic clout is for coercion or punishment. And there's a few issues upon which that it's pretty likely that they're going to do so. And the number one on the top of that list is the Dalai Lama. So receiving the Dalai Lama by the formal visit to a head of state in any country generally tends to bring about not just Chinese diplomatic criticism, but some economic punishments. And that certainly has been the case. Certainly France was an example of that. It's unclear how effective this is.
But there was this punishment, I think about Airbus orders, but other things too. And France caved.
Right. And that generally in Europe, for example, Europe's a good example. You see a series of sort of responses to different actions, whether it's France or Norway over the Liu Xiaobo's Nobel Prize, where you see economic punishments. And sometimes this can take the form of a negative punishment, canceling orders. After Sarkozy's visit, discussion with the Dalai Lama, an eventual meeting, Chinese sent purchasing delegations, what the Chinese call Taigo Waijiao, or purchasing diplomacy. So these delegations went to other countries around France. Indeed, premier at the time, Wen Jiabao, called this the circling around France tour, Rao Fa Zhilu, the tour around France, where they spent a lot of money in France's neighbors.
Yeah, the Chinese premier at the time made no secret of the fact that it's not like he didn't mention it. He really made a point of mentioning it, didn't he?
That's right. I mean, the goal is to not to have to do this. Like any sort of threat, you don't want to actually have to implement the punishment. So if they can make one instance and make other countries sort of understand what's likely to happen, hopefully they can avoid having to ever use the economic stick.
There's concern in our region about increasing Chinese investment and influence in the South Pacific. James Lawrenson from UTS.
I find it a bit hard to take too hard a line on China when it's the Pacific Island countries themselves that are demanding this capital. If you listen to what the leaders of Pacific Island countries say, they will say quite openly, gee, we need more infrastructure. Australia wasn't funding it before. The World Bank wasn't funding it. The Asia Development Bank wasn't funding it. China's come along and now has started funding it. Although I note that while Chinese investment in these countries is growing quickly, it's still a long way behind the combined stock of investment from countries like Australia and New Zealand. So I'm more inclined to listen to a Pacific Island leader than I am to some commentator sitting in Canberra.
You can understand the concern of countries like Australia, New Zealand, perhaps the United States, though, because China's not doing this out of the goodness of its heart. It'll have a strategic goal, just as a country like America would too.
Sure, and Australia as well. But these things aren't necessarily mutually exclusive. A Chinese investment can indeed promote development and living standards in these Pacific Island countries at the same time as it might serve a Chinese strategic purpose as well.
James Riley says we tend to think that everything China does in this regard is centrally directed.
I think it's useful to understand the different actors involved and what their interests are in this regard. So the banks, I think, primarily want to make money, want to have a return on their investment, but they certainly would like to also make their political leaders satisfied with them. The same is true for the state-owned enterprises, although the commercial imperative is even more important for them. Overwhelmingly, they're evaluated based on the success of their commercial venture. There are certainly diplomats which would very much appreciate these companies or banks coming in and providing projects in a way that advance foreign policy objectives. But those diplomats don't run the companies or the banks. And so it's often a challenge, I think, for Chinese diplomats or even strategists to try to convince the folks with the money, the banks and the large companies, to actually do something that would advance China's foreign policy goals. The only place where those come together is at the very apex, the very top of the Chinese political leadership structure. And here, I think the major constraining factor is, quite frankly, time. Xi Jinping is busy. And so the sort of energy and resources they have to dedicate to any particular task, I think, is going to be limited.
Today on The Money, China. On the evening before Malcolm Turnbull was rolled as Prime Minister, the government quietly made it clear that Chinese tech giant Huawei wouldn't be allowed to build the 5G mobile network. This has not gone down well in Beijing. And it's part of a pattern of greater caution about China from the Australian government. Jane Golly.
It's a very fraught time to be talking about Australia-China relations, and I think it does come down to what a big shift in 2017 that came with Xi Jinping's decision at the 19th Party Congress in October last year to make himself essentially what, you know, people are calling the leader for life, if that's what he wants, to enshrine his own thought in the constitution, elevating himself actually above Deng Xiaoping and putting him on a par with Mao Zedong. I mean, that scared people and, you know, and it really drove home this point that I'm making that China isn't going to become like us. It's going to become something quite different. And we should have realised that earlier, but in a sense, we didn't, and we were busily taking advantage of those wonderful economic opportunities, you know, as were the Jack Ma's of this world, sharing in that sort of collective gains from trade and talking all about the economics of it. But, you know, the realisation of difference, I think, has come to a head, and I don't think Australians are particularly good at dealing with that.
So if Beijing wanted to make a point economically, what could it do? James Riley.
Potentially, there's a lot that theoretically China could do. There's a lot of reliance in this country upon trade with China. My own university, the University of Sydney, and universities around this country rely very heavily on Chinese student income. Chinese tourism is very important in this country. Investment into various sectors is growing rather rapidly into Australia. And of course, Australia's largest trading partner is China. So a large share of our exports go up to China. So across a variety of sectors, there's potentially a lot of economic clout if China was to sort of close the door. But that would be extremely destructive for Chinese interests. There's a lot of Chinese people making money. Students come here because they want to learn and tourists want to visit. So I think for the most part, there would be a real reluctance on the part of China to sort of heavily coerce or try to pressure Australia too overtly, partly because of the interest within China in the trading relationship and partly because of this kind of anxiety or fears signals that might send around the world.
Short of a punishment of some kind, is the Australian economy at risk because of our exposure to China? James Lawrenson from UTS.
Over the last couple of years, there's been some good efforts from the International Monetary Fund, the Asia Development Bank, and academic economists in Australia. And you might be surprised to learn that even a pretty big shock, that is a Chinese economic hard landing, say growth in China slows from 6.7% now to 3%, that's a big slump, the impact on Australia may not be so severe. Most of the modelling points to around a 0.5 percentage point decline. So in other words, if Australia is currently growing at around 3%, which we are, then even if there was a big shock in China, that might bring growth in Australia back to 2.5%. So it's negative, it's material, but it's not devastating. There's a few reasons for that. One is that while most of our exports, or a third of our exports, go to China, exports in total are not actually a big part of the Australian economy. For example, 70% of the Australian economy is made up of domestic consumption. So we're shipping a lot to China, but exports in total aren't such a big part of our economy. Second point is the investment linkages. So when the US economy goes pear-shaped, we have effects in Australia, but it's because it's transmitted by financial flows through investment. The stock of Chinese investment in Australia at the moment is around one-tenth that of the US. So while we trade with China a lot, we don't actually have a lot of investment linkages. And finally, the Australian economy has some natural inbuilt buffers, most obviously a flexible exchange rate. So you can be sure that if the Chinese economy had a hiccup, the Australian dollar would depreciate, and that, of course, would make our goods and services cheaper, more competitive to all the other countries of the world.
But China has a debt problem, a very big one, now estimated to be three times as large as its GDP.
I think you could point to it as the biggest potential problem that China is facing. The numbers are big. I won't talk in terms of percentages of GDP. They're pretty meaningless to most people anyway, although you could, in comparative terms, say that Australia has a worse debt problem than China in terms of what we owe the rest of the world as a share of our GDP. The numbers are going to be big in China because it's the second largest economy. The question is, can the government deal with crises that come their way? I mean, a crisis by definition is something that we're not going to be able to forecast. And so I'm not going to sit here and say there won't be one because I don't know what can happen tomorrow. And it could happen tomorrow that there's a run on the banks and that people start to think that a debt problem is about to unfold.
China isn't yet a fully developed economy. It's what's called a middle-income country. And it might remain one.
China now, the per capita income is above 80,000. That being defined as a kind of a middle-income stage. basically ranges from 4,000 or 5,000 to 8,000 or even 9. The next step of development is to reach the per capita income level, something like 12,000. 12,000 is the benchmark where you can define as being admitted to the club of a developed country. So China is yet to reach that stage. And given that the economy is, the growth is slowing down, and the economy facing enormous challenges, new challenges. So therefore, this is a debate about the middle income trap. Because in the post-war period, majority of the countries, when they reach the level of this kind of a middle level, middle income level, the economy becomes stagnant. So meaning that those economies are falling into the middle income trap.
As Li Gongsong says, China faces real challenges.
The number one challenger perhaps is that the growth of China in the past largely are driven by, we call this the old model of growth, which rely heavily on the capital investment. And of course, China has a very high level of saving, so therefore they can meet these kind of requirements for investment. And of course, it's the labor force as well. But simply relying on the factor of production, like added labor and capital, that has a certain problem as a bottleneck. So China need to develop a model which actually rely on more on the innovation, technology, and the productivity. So the economy is in a transition towards that one.
There's also the environment. There's a lot to fix there. And something that barely existed 40 years ago, inequality. James Lawrenson.
If you're talking about Shanghai or Beijing or Tianjin, Jiangsu, these are cities and provinces along the coast, those places already have levels of income that the World Bank would say they qualify as a high income location, a high income country. But correct, go to Gansu, go to Xinjiang, and levels of wealth there are a lot less. That does also point for the potential for those provinces to catch up, of course, which in the long term is probably a pretty good story.
It would be a good story, and it's likely to be important for the future of China. The country might be home to more billionaires than anywhere else, but the overwhelming majority are not rich, and they're really important. Jane Golly.
How the world changes will have a lot more to do with how they respond to China's changing position in the world, how they respond to the increasing repression, if you like, within the national boundaries, you know, how they react to growing inequalities if they're not well addressed by the government. I think they're really going to determine the nature of China's sort of global engagement and its own domestic prospects in the decades ahead.
Thanks to Jane Golly, Acting Director of the China in the World Centre at the ANU, James Lawrenson, Deputy Director of Australia-China Relations Institute at UTS, Li Gongsong, Professor of Economics at the Australian National University, and James Riley from the University of Sydney. The Money is produced by Belinda Summer. Our sound engineer is Tim Jenkins. I'm Richard Aidy.